I think we'll go ahead and begin. I'm Petter Jovin. According to my 4¼-year-old son, I just retired from the World Cup. Apparently that's what he was telling people on Sunday. But I teach at Sinnoh College. I am a Christian ethicist by training. My specialty is a guy named Søren Kierkegaard. So I will wheedle him in here and there. And that's what I work on. The session today is on vocation. But this session, which lasts an hour, is not just an hour. It also bleeds into a session that starts at 6, run by my lovely wife, who's upstairs, who also teaches at St. Olaf. She's a writer. So the hope, and one of the hopes, is that we would still be married after we finish this week. So far, we're okay. Right? We're okay. We're still talking.
No, she's up there.
Right. That was one hope. But the other hope is to sort of talk about, raise some issues, in particular in conversation with the biblical stories, about questions, about themes, and then to work through them by writing about them later with Kata. So I encourage you to do that. But yesterday's session was really fruitful. I almost think we should just talk about bodies. Today we're talking about vocation. And for this, I want you to find someone you don't know, introduce yourself, and I want you to talk about what you hear when you hear the word vocation. What comes to mind? Introduce yourself. So what came to mind when you talked about vocation? What popped up? Some things you thought about.
Well, what is your job?
Your job. Is that that?
I did.
Your job. Say more. Job.
I just said, when you said vocation, the first thing that popped in my head is asking, so what is your job, what do you do? Or, you know, what do you maybe get paid to do? And then in our conversation, she said, well, also, what do you do that's not necessarily paid, but is your vocation? So we talked about that.
Okay. So your job, is your job then parenthood?
No, I'm back to work full time, but parenthood tends to then take the second chair. Yeah.
Okay. So part of vocation, I think when we use the word, does deal with employment, a job. It's what you do and you get paid to do. And certainly that's part of the tradition of vocation. What else came up? Yeah.
Now that I'm retired, I think of vocation as purpose. What's my purpose?
You said that too? So what gives you life meaning and purpose? What makes you get up in the morning? Independently, possibly, of getting paid. If you're retired, you're asking those kind of questions, I imagine, that are independent of, oh, I need to have an income to live a certain lifestyle. So, yeah.
This might still be answering the first question, but it's how you do what you do as well as what it is.
Yeah. Say more. How. I love that. It's actually very Kierkegaardian.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm kind of imprinted with Lutheran ideas, so.
Yeah, great. I think many of us in here are.
Yeah, we can.
But it's not just, well, I'll pick Luther's example of Mary changing Jesus' diapers and how that's a calling. But it's how you do it, not just that you did it or not.
Well, I love the fact you use calling, and I'm surprised no one has brought it up yet. I mean, often vocation is associated with calling. In the Latin vocare, it means to be called. And Luther, in fact, I think one of the beauties of Lutheran theology, there's lots of ugliness in Lutheran theology, but one of the beauties is the expectation, for instance, dads in changing the child's diaper or doing their calling. Mm-hmm. And he said that in the sermon. But calling's important. Purpose is important. I think that's really what we get to when we start to think about vocation.
Thing that I think was so strong about Luther is that at his time, calling was only to a religious order, and he said, no, everybody has a calling to do and be what God is calling you to do and be. And it's so that it's not just being in a religious order.
He felt people were called to be parents, people were called to be citizens, people called to be part of a family.
Can you be called without God?
That's a good question.
Call to be equal.
Who's doing the calling?
Call to be equal.
Can we be called
without God?
Oh, yep.
Yeah, I think that's like the world can be calling you. Like there can be a need in the world that you need to, that you have, that you can fulfill. And so the world can call you.
So you think you can call you. The call from the world is independent of the call from God.
It would be nice if they're related, but if you're not a person of faith, I think it's fine to feel a call from the world as well. Okay.
Yeah. I think it can also feel like you can think it's a calling, but it maybe is more of a self-fulfilling, putting yourself in the place of God. And I think for the calling to be truly fulfilling, I think it does need to be from God.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
That's great.
One element in that is the feeling of when there's a call, it's things that were sort of like born into you. Not the whole, I don't think this is the whole of it. Where you got to almost feel like even your spleen is kind of like pulled in that direction or something. But kind of deep elements laid into you, probably down in your DNA, are kind of being sung to in a certain way. It stirs them up.
But what we've also gotten into is a thorny thicket of different kinds of callings. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the challenges we face, and I'll shift to this, is that we're called by lots of things. I think we're constantly bombarded with callings from the world. But they're callings in many ways to be certain kinds of people. Most of us, what is this person being called? What are you being called by this advertisement?
To go fishing.
To go fishing.
Oh, but to buy Patagonia sportswear to go fishing.
Which identifies you as a particular kind of person. You're someone who cares about where your clothes come from. You care about sort of recyclable fleece. And Patagonia will fix your coats. Don't buy a new one. We'll fix it for you. Certainly better than other kind of forms of, I suppose, conspicuous consumption. But, what's this calling? What? Go ahead. What?
You. Go ahead.
Selling cosmetics.
Selling cosmetics. So what are you being called? What are we being called?
To be beauty.
So physical beauty, I think, mm-hmm. primarily.
Yeah.
Like to look and appear a certain way, back to the body issues that we talked about yesterday. These are some of my favorite callings. What's that kind of calling? Anyone deconstruct that calling? Who's doing the work?
Dude.
Men.
Men.
Men. Manly men.
Oh, Chevy.
Guys in
Chevy.
Yeah, Chevy trucks. You're tough. Like a rock. Remember, that was the ad campaign from when I was in college. Chevy trucks like a rock. It's not just a truck, it's your identity as a man. Here, too, it's a healthier house than I have.
Bleach.
Start drinking. I think the challenge then for us, and the challenge I'm asking us to reflect on, is what is our calling as Christians? Because we are always in tension with other callings. And some of them are good callings. I mean, it's good probably to go and fish outside and appreciate God's creation. It's one of the things Diane's been talking about these last few days. Yeah?
I think everyone is called. Some hear it, some don't. And of those that hear it, some follow it, and some don't. But we're all called.
Of course, the challenge is, what are we called to do? What do we call lie? I think another calling that we have, and this goes to John's session, is we're called to be citizens. And I think the big tension for many Christians is, and 2 weeks ago, the highest legal official in the land said that we're all supposed to be obedient to our government because that's what the Bible says, Romans 13. Good Christian, good U.S. citizen. Tomorrow's the 4th. I always feel tension with the 4th. I finally have started putting, I don't know if Kate has noticed this, this year I put out an American flag on Memorial Day. Even though there are times I have been embarrassed to be an American. In fact, often when I
chance to travel to college in Europe. I tell them I was Canadian. But I want to reclaim the fact that I am American, and maybe as a good to be a good citizen requires me to say, I want America to be the country that I believe it should be and can be. A lot of what John was talking about this week. So I think the challenge for us is, what are our callings as Christians? And amidst those tensions, and those frankly different identities.
I've always liked the hands and feet of Christ as a calling for Christian life.
Say more.
Be the hands and feet of Christ. Follow the teachings. Advocate for what Christ would want us to do and be in the world. And work. Serve. Hands and feet.
Perfect.
And the details of that are different for each person.
Right.
But it's all the same purpose.
Thank you, both of you. You're my plants. We just to the next slide. Part of what I'm going to suggest is that when we talk about vocation, among other things, we're talking about mimesis. Mimesis means imitation. Mimesis is to reduplicate something. And I think the predominant calling for Christians is to reduplicate Christ. You are to become like Christ. And one of my favorite quotes from a guy named Kierkegaard, whose name I misspelled, didn't I? I think I did.
Yeah.
There's a B. Yeah. He wrote, this is from Practice of Christianity, Christ came to the world with the purpose of saving the world, also with the purpose of being the prototype of leaving footprints for the person who wanted to join him, who then might become an imitator. This indeed corresponds to footprints.
Let me try this. So as followers of Christ, are we called to purity or called to impurity? Hmm. And to be called like Christ, are we better than the world-to-world calling? World meaning just simply worldly, a worldly calling to make the world better. And it seems to me that that the world-to-world sense of calling is as legitimate as our Christian calling. Lord, as Christian callers, do we put a body check
That's a great question.
On the world? That's a great or where question. Do we go with that?
Yeah. There's a book that was published, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. It's called The Benedict Option. Mm-hmm. Anyone familiar with it?
The what option?
The Benedict Option.
No.
And The Benedict Option is based on the rule of St. Benedict. And it's the idea that Christians, and because the world is corrupt and the world cannot be repaired, Christians must withdraw to places like Holden and live at Holden and be separate from the world. I hear that's sort of what you're getting at, but that's... Some Christians think that that's a viable option, but you don't. And I think the way I was going to present it is that I'm going to use Bonhoeffer,
yeah,
who wrestled with this very question.
Yeah.
And he wrestled it quite well in the text called Discipleship, as well as Ethics.
That circles back to Romans 13. You say Sessions said we are to be obedient. That's what Yoder wrote that whole book about. It's to be subject to governing authorities.
Well, actually, the Greek isn't governing authorities.
But it's
higher authorities.
Higher powers.
And it's rooted in Romans 13:8, because we will talk about this in our Vespers planning, which is really, if government avoids the true sort of order of the creation, which is love, then the government itself is suspect.
Right, and obedience is much different than subject. In other words, you can be civilly disobedient and still be a subject of the government. Or if you live down lake, you don't need to retreat here, and you can be consistent with your own values and be a subject.
Which is the hard part.
Mm. Right.
But I think that's what Bonhoeffer's getting at. I mean, for Bonhoeffer, it's existential. is the fancy word I'm using. Ricky?
I always have a problem with the mimetic piece, because I remember John Schramm sitting here many years ago and saying, if you want to be a follower of Christ, you got to look good on wood. And I don't want to go there. And so then, you know, so then I feel like in that respect, I'm a failure, because I don't want to look good on wood.
What does
and
it
so,
mean look good on wood?
Being cross. And I, you know, so then I feel like a failure and like, well, forget that. So.
Well, let's keep that question, because we're going to read 2 Maccabees, which is really a horrific torture text.
Good. Great.
And I want to ask that question, like, how far down does our duty as disciples and followers of Christ who did die? Yeah.
I think there's two big biblical mandates, the Great Commission and the Great Commandment. So you can boil them down to love God, love your neighbor, tell the world. You know, those are the things we're supposed to be doing. So get yourself crucified is not necessarily one of them. So I'm with you.
But I would just add that maybe be willing to be sacrificed when that duty is your calling. Like, just be prepared for that as an option.
These are great themes. I hope we stay with them, Bill.
I'm struggling trying to figure out how we're having this conversation here and having the conversation with people who can't be here because they're working for the man and they see their vocation as their job. They feel they're being used in the factory, coal mines, whatever. And it's to separate the feelings of privilege to have this discussion. It truly is a privilege versus how do we include this concept of vocation in a meaningful way with all of us? Because I think that's a big division in our country right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You guys are having this discussion. I'm going to work.
Well, I see that every day teaching at St. Lawrence.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not. There's a sizable, relatively speaking, relative to even when I started 13 years ago, number of folks who are socioeconomically disadvantaged. But most people at Olaf were Patagonia.
Yeah.
Patagonia tells you what socioeconomic class you're a part of.
Sure. You know, but you know, in my own sense of a Christian context, the calling doesn't feel to me very much anymore. As a young person, it did this kind of dichotomy. But it really are things like being called to the road to Bethlehem during Advent, being called to really participate in Lent in some kind of way, being called forth to communion, you know, to actually the calendrics count, and they're so vast. It's like the cosmos itself or something upon which you can really stretch a Christian conscience and have things occurring to it, you know, we're receiving many spiritual blessings of various kinds that pertain to how you move through the year. I mean, and what the reason why I say it now is I know these conversations move fast, but also is that the stink up that has occurred every year around the world, the war on Christmas or something, instead of there being this call to actually manifest a blessing, like that's like baking bread that other people can really eat. It's been humiliating to watch that play out year after year, as if Christianity has nothing to give the world, but its spiritual stinginess or its sense of injury. So perverse to me. And the sense of injury is sitting there right behind getting on the cross or being martyred. And it's hard to grow old and not see how those things interconnect. Their great gift seems to be the year itself.
I just wanted to push back a little on the sort of the characterization of blue-collar workers. I mean, large part of my family is blue-collar workers, very poor in northern Wisconsin. And I look at my cousins often as an example because they have much stronger faith than I do, and they don't feel victimized by their condition. So I just wanted to make that statement.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, part of the tension, I think, in Christianity is that where do your allegiances lie? What ultimately defines your identity and how you exist in the world? Which to me, Bonhoeffer sort of gets to here. Discipleship is a commitment to Christ. Because Christ exists, he must be followed. An idea about Christ, a doctrinal system, a general religious recognition of grace or forgiveness of sins does not require discipleship. I think the command that he's offering here, his interpretation, I suppose, is that it, live it. You don't just talk about it. And I think that's the real difficult part. I think it's easy to talk. It's easy to talk about, but it's hard to exist that way. And I think that that's where sort of the demands of vocation hit us as Christians. It's uncomfortable. Cross is neither misfortune nor harsh fate. Instead, it is that suffering which comes from our allegiance to Jesus Christ alone. The cross is not random suffering, but necessary suffering. The cross is not suffering that stems from natural existence, just being a physical body. It is suffering that comes from being Christian. The essence of the cross is not suffering alone. It is suffering and being rejected. Strictly speaking, it is being rejected for the sake of Jesus Christ, not for the sake of any other attitude or confession. A Christianity that no longer took discipleship seriously or made the gospel into only the solus of cheap grace. Only one who is bound to Christ as this occurs, and discipleship stands in seriousness on the cross. I think the tendency in our culture is to turn things into an either-or. And I think what the Christian tradition, especially the Protestant tradition, offers is an in-betweenness, a both-and. For instance, Luther offered his view of something called the two kingdoms, that you're both sort of a member of the body of Christ, but also a member of a physical state. Goes back to Augustine. The question then is, how do you live in both without denying both? Because in part, the world calls you. We're called to be American citizens, or we're called to Holden, or you're called to whatever citizenship. We're called to this place. I'm called as a parent. I'm called as a husband. I'm called as a friend. But I'm also called to follow Christ. How do you inhabit that tension? How do you deal with that tension? And I think that's the real challenge. In fact, when I hear necessary suffering, to me, what Bonhoeffer in some ways is getting to, that there's suffering intended. It's uncomfortable because you don't fit in either categories. Exactly like you're supposed to or want to. The reality of it is, how do you enact that tension? How do you enact in hopeful ways? So. Another voice to bring into is that Christianity is countercultural when it comes to discipleship. And this comes from James Cone. He's a black theologian who died maybe a month ago. Mm-hmm. Black Theology of Liberation, one of my favorite books. Hard book, but important. Discipleship is dangerous because the true prophet of the gospel of God must become both anti-Christian and unpatriotic. It is impossible to confront a racist society. And I think we could shift not just racist, sexist,
violent,
social and unjust society, violent. I think there's lots of terms that I think Cone would approve of to be put in there. He's speaking from his black experience, though. With the meaning of human existence grounded in commitment to the divine, without at the same time challenging the very existence of the national structure and all of its institutions, especially the established churches. All national institutions represent the interests of the society as a whole. We live in a nation which is committed to the perpetuation of white supremacy, and will try to exterminate all who fail to support this ideal. The genocide of the American Indian is evidence of that fact. Black theology represents that community of blacks who refuse to cooperate in the exaltation of whiteness and the degradation of blackness. Proclaims the reality of the biblical God who is actively destroying everything that is against the manifestation of black human dignity. And I'll just point out, this was written in the late 60s, early 70s. Any responses to this sort of view of discipleship?
Could have been written today.
certainly relevant to that. I mean, I think the challenge that Cohn is getting, that echoes, he's in conversation with Bonhoeffer, he's in conversation with Kierkegaard, he's in conversation with Luther. He appreciates the way that they come up with a very relational God, a relational God that is a part of active struggles in the world, the suffering of the people. But we too often get comfortable in the rules or the order or the norms. And I think his point is you always have to question because ultimately they serve someone. They serve someone. So with this, I want to turn to two sort of biblical stories of vocation. And I think we've brought up a lot of great themes. And what I'd like you to do now is maybe find three other people, hopefully people you don't know. Again, Holden's a beautiful place to make new friendships and to have further conversations around these challenging issues. And how about we read 2 Maccabees first? And yeah, just a word of caution. It is a torture text, literally. Just some background. It's not canonical in either the Jewish or Christian traditions. The Lutherans, it's apocryphal, which means sort of hidden books or hidden texts. It's interesting as a historical text. Likely it was written sometime in the 150s or 160s BCE after a revolt led by Judas Maccabees against the Greek king Antiochus Epiphanes IV. I think that's how you pronounce Epiphanes, but it would be pronounced different ways, but it's always kind of fun to say. He was a Greek king. He was basically a descendant of a general of Alexander the Great. And being a Greek king, he wanted to Hellenize Jerusalem. So in the 160s, he actually took over the Jewish temple and tried to change the calendar as well as the sacred holidays, and there was a revolt. The big event and why, and it's not canonical in the Jewish tradition, but it's important because it describes Hanukkah. So that's the background. So what we're reading is a mom and seven sons. And they refuse basically to adhere to Greek values, which they're being demanded by the king, Antiochus, to do. So what I'd like you to think about is, again, we've talked about a lot of different ways of, or connected, I suppose, vocationally. But I'd like you to read this text, and what does it call Christians, as we read this, in terms of its relationship to culture and institutions of political power, to discipleship? What's the expectation? Good? Yeah. So everyone find maybe three other people. Everyone have a copy of the... Try to find people again you do sure. Not know. Introduce yourself. How does this challenge our assumptions about vocation and discipleship? What's our response?
I think I'd fall short.
Say more.
I say, well, I would not have the strength of faith to do that. So I would fall short.
But in the good thing is the Lutheran tradition convicts us.
Yeah.
That we're not living up to the call of discipleship from God. Other responses. Yeah.
But they were also very aware that they weren't living up to discipleship. They, you know, this is just punishment,
right? Mm-hmm.
As well as our martyrdom and our conviction that we will also be cared for. So it's all three things.
Yeah, good. Exactly. Yeah. And there's a deeper order, a deeper divine sense of justice that's going on, that the justification for the fact that the Greeks are there in the first place has to go back to iniquities and idolatry, I suspect. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This might meander, but
that's what we do.
Prior to reading this, one of the thoughts that came to me about vocation was from our baptismal promises that we read about living among God's faithful people, putting scriptures in the hands of the baptized, those things. So when I read this, I thought, well, the vocation, their discipleship was successful because it happened before these events. Like the success of their discipleship is their resilience to these sufferings. And so what we're seeing, and I read the, I have to read the passage about the mother, and she's telling her son, remember all those things I taught you. Mm-hmm. Like, now is the time. Mm-hmm. And make sure that you will also be with your brothers and me, because I'm paraphrasing, but maybe that gives us a vision of vocation as building resilience to whatever sufferings will come. Mm-hmm. That's our call.
That's beautiful.
But this is the very attitude that we condemn in the Muslim religion with the people that wear vests that blow up and that sort of stuff. They know they're right. They're absolutely right. And they will go to their death.
But these seven sons didn't kill anyone. Right. They were killed. I think that's the point.
Of course, we also
I'm not comfortable with
the national anthem.
An currently existing religion that tells people they ought to do this kind of stuff.
Well, you think of Jim Jones, for instance. I mean, really close at hand, where the voice of the mother is not all that different, probably, than the leadership of the Jones called on in Guyana when they're doing the Kool-Aid ceremony. I understand this veers far from what this message is.
Well, I think the voice of the mother also shows up in, like, people, you know, creating lawsuits that will make their way up to the Supreme Court to say, like, I will be the Christian vacating martyr. I think it's really I think martyrdom is a really dangerous thing in the tradition, and that it is used by both sides to get what they want, to show I'm willing to die for this thing. It's like the most extreme example.
I think this is all background for the, you were saying before, the martyrdom in the early church. Like, especially Perpetua and Felicity, they're in the Roman arena, and she like takes the sword and guides it to her own neck, and it's like, hello, don't you want to live to witness? Mm-hmm. You know, is dying to witness really the better path?
Mm-hmm. Well, one real challenge I think of this text, there are New Testament scholars as far as I know, and maybe some of you might know better, but there are scholars who argue that this story is in the memory of the gospel writers, particularly Mark. Mm-hmm. You read Mark, that Mark is a very bleak gospel. Mm-hmm. Jesus three times says, if you want to follow me, you're going to die. Take up your cross. Mark is also written at a time when the world has fallen apart. The Jerusalem temple has been destroyed. Jerusalem has been destroyed. And I do think that the Christian tradition, because it values, it canonizes certain kinds of stories, that the stories it valuizes are a time of disorder, and they're messy. And I think too often we ignore the messiness rather than accept the messiness and live that messiness, that betweenness. That maybe there are some contexts that demand this kind of discipleship. Go ahead.
Just when you put it in the context, I just immediately thought, like, it's not until you have nothing left to lose that you're willing to lose your life. Like, it takes those extreme contexts for martyrdom to seem like the best route.
So the context of...
Yeah. When you point out that, hey, the temple's been destroyed and you know, your whole culture is about to be extinguished potentially, and now's the time. Like, you have nothing to lose, so just.
So do you think that's a break then on sort of Jim Jones, the cultic sort of direction?
I'm not very familiar with this Jim Jones.
It was in the '70s, so a lot of people are young.
There's a group of. They drank Kool-Aid and like 600 people died.
Yeah.
It was
children. Everybody.
Christian
everyone.
Love Temple, or wasn't that what
the
it,
People's
it,
Temple?
Portland, weren't Portland.
The People's Temple.
People's Temple.
Well, I don't think there's much of a difference. I mean,
you don't think there's
much of a difference. Those people who drank the Kool-Aid, I mean, they were really sure about it.
Most of the people apparently didn't know they were drinking Kool-Aid.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe that.
As far as I know,
that doesn't sound.
That's what I remember reading once, but I mean, that's, I don't know. If any of you remember it better than I do.
I remember that, well, they weren't in Portland, though, they were down in.
Eureka, California.
And anyway, they had the parents give the Kool-Aid to the kids, and then the parents drink.
It's very, for folks who are younger, if you have an opportunity to watch a documentary or read about it, it's very compelling because it makes you not question Christian martyrdom necessarily, but kind of explore what extremism means for Christians, mm-hmm. and where you draw the line to say what. Mm-hmm. What is defending your righteousness or your culture, and what is extremism and false values? So, anyway.
Well, you brought up a really good point too. I think about just in our recent cultural moment that there have been a lot of Christians that sort of with the child separation stuff at the border mm-hmm. kind of drew a line, and even if they've been okay with. Some Trump decisions up until then, like got to that point and were like, oh wait, not cool with this.
That was a funny point.
Yeah, and so that reading this, we were just talking about in reading the story, maybe it's not so much about martyrdom so much as it is about questioning like, what is the point at which to commit an action? Like for them it's eating swine, which like probably is not a big deal to lots of us, but like what is the point at which you would commit an action which you could no longer live with yourself mm-hmm. as a Christian or a human in the world. And I'm, you know, like, if somebody put a 2-year-old in front of me and was like, you have to kill this 2-year-old, I probably would say, kill me first. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. that, like, to do that would mean mm-hmm. that I could no longer, you know, like, I couldn't live with, I don't know. Like, so I wonder if it's more about what are our vocational kind of lines?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Tipping points, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder about our attitudes towards institutions under all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even in the James Cone quote, and I think it's a great quote, but sometimes the alternative to institutions today is fulfilling myself.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with the vocation to a higher calling.
Mm-hmm.
It's don't let that institution
mess
with me.
Or make a demand on you. That's for a sacrifice.
And so what's the alternative to institutions? I mean, is sometimes the institution the one that's actually the better vocational choice? Rather than resisting the institution. I think it's more complicated than these kinds of texts make it out to be.
In our times, the institutions, in a sense, are a cross.
Yeah.
Are you capable of letting go of a personal feeling to embrace an impersonal value that transcends really your own right?
The
it's the right of somebody else. It might trump yours, or you go through a divorce and you have to value the way that the institution sorts out something. You go through deeply or personal on personal things, both are going to have to make sacrifices. Something's going to, it's bigger than just one person's climbing up there. And
so you almost need to ask the community question.
Yeah. Well, I was also going to say that I think the other side of that, especially for younger generations when it comes to the Christian tradition, the institution of the Christian church, is apathy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
These institutions are imperfect, and because they're imperfect, whatever, I don't need it. I'll just hang out with my friends and watch football.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, that is a danger, and part of the danger, I think, even of cultish, is that you end up ignoring a tradition that has meandered its way over how many hundred thousands of years, that has resources. And in fact, I was going to pair, and we're almost done, I was going to pair this with Mary's call, because the tradition has both. It has this kind of example of discipleship and martyrdom. Witness is where the word martyr comes from. But then you have Mary of being a servant. I mean, we all know the, I suspect we all know from holding even prayer.
The sword will pierce her heart also.
The tradition has both. And we have to navigate and meander and relate to both those demands. And it's hard. It's not easy. But that's, to me, that's what we're called as Christians to do. And to ask this kind of question, what is the point where you cannot live with yourself? You cannot.
Well, we have it right now with this immigration stuff.
Any last thoughts? Well, I encourage you, I encourage you to attend CADA sessions.
We're going to actually take up some of these. We're going to look at some passages from Remains of the Day. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that book or film.
Remains of the Day
is one of the opportunities which takes up a lot of these issues about vocation, especially in the context of authority.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.